Sorry to cut those conversations short. You can do round two at supper. My name is James. If I don't know you, good to see you here tonight. We at Church by the Bridge have been looking at the big book of Isaiah in the Old Testament. And we are almost at the halfway point. And we come to halfway through the book and we hit a story. It is a story of two kings. I'm going to tell you this story now and then we'll finish off with the Bible reading. So the battle of two kings. The first king was King Sennacherib. Now, Sennacherib was an impressive and powerful king. Every time he flexed his military muscle, nations would be crushed by the weight of it. He had destroyed so many nations and Jerusalem was next on the menu. Then there's King Hezekiah. King Hezekiah is not all that impressive. There's rumors of impeaching him. His people and him lay behind a besieged city, behind the walls, cowering in fear of Sennacherib. Sennacherib had taken so much and they knew he was coming for what was left. Two kings. King Sennacherib sent the best propaganda artist he knew, Rabshakeh. And Rabshakeh came not with a sword but with words. And Rabshakeh stood at the wall of Jerusalem and shouted out, "O Jerusalem, you have no chance of survival. What are you relying on? I mean, you have no allies. They'll let you down if you did. Your military is pithy. Even your God, the God you worship, well, guess what? He called and said, take him out. You got nothing left." At this point, the Jewish politicians say, Rabshakeh, could you speak in Aramaic and not Hebrew so that the people don't understand? Rabshakeh kept speaking in Hebrew and says, "By the time we are done with you, all you will have left is your poo and urine to feast on. Do not trust in your king Hezekiah," he said, "who keeps whimpering, 'The Lord will save us, the Lord will save us.' There is no chance of survival. But if you give up, we will give you paradise." When King Hezekiah heard this report, he broke down and he went to the temple. So the city of Jerusalem stood waiting. King Sennacherib sent a response to ramp up the pressure. He sent a letter personally to Hezekiah. Outlining in this letter was his resume of all the nations he'd destroyed, all the kings he had killed, all the gods he had crushed. And the message was clear: you, Hezekiah, are next. You and your God. So Hezekiah took this letter and laid it in the temple before God and said, "God, what are we going to do?" And God's response is simply breathtaking. I'm going to invite Emma up now, who's going to read to us Isaiah 37. If you want to turn there now.
Yep, so Isaiah 37, starting from verse 21, which can be found on page 655. So if you want to look on or find it yourself. Great. "Then Isaiah, son of Amoz, sent a message to Hezekiah. The Lord, the God of Israel, says, 'Because you prayed to me about Sennacherib, king of Assyria, this is the word the Lord has spoken against him. Virgin daughter Zion despises you and scorns you. Daughter Jerusalem shakes her head behind your back. Who is it you have mocked and blasphemed? Who have you raised your voice against and lifted your eyes in pride? Against the Holy One of Israel. You have mocked the Lord through your servants. You have said, 'With my many chariots I have gone up to the heights of the mountains, to the far recesses of Lebanon. I cut down its tallest cedars, its choice cypress trees. I came to its distant heights, its densest forest. I dug wells and drank water. I dried up all the streams of Egypt with the soles of my feet. Have you not heard? I designed it long ago. I planned it in the days gone by. I have now brought it to pass. And you have crushed fortified cities into piles of rubble. Their inhabitants have become powerless, dismayed and ashamed. They are plants of the field, tender grass on the rooftops, blasted by the east wind. But I know you're sitting down, you're going out and you're coming in, and you're raging against me. Because you're raging against me and your arrogance have reached my ears, I will put my hook in your nose and my bit in your mouth. I will make you go back the way you came. This will be the sign for you. This year you will eat what grows on its own, and in the second year what grows from that. But in the third year sow and reap, plant vineyards and eat their fruit. The surviving remnant of the house of Judah will again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For a remnant will go out from Jerusalem and survivors from Mount Zion. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. Therefore, this is what the Lord says about the king of Assyria. He will not enter this city or shoot an arrow there or come before it with a shield or build up an assault ramp against it. He will go back the way he came and he will not enter this city. This is the Lord's declaration. I will defend this city and rescue it because of me and because of my servant David. Then the angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. When the people got up the next morning, there were all the dead bodies. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, broke camp and left. He returned home and lived in Nineveh. One day, while he was worshipping in the temple of his god Nisroch, his sons, Adrammelech and Sherezer, struck him down with a sword and escaped to the land of Ararat. Then his son, Esarhaddon, became king in his place. This is the word of the Lord.
To God. One of my favourite books is a book by Joseph Cummins called Turn Around and Run Like Hell. It's about military strategies that shouldn't have worked but did. And I think Isaiah 36 to 37 could have been a chapter in this book. I don't think it's not, but it could have been. It's a great story. It's a great story of epic battles in terms of you've got a small, pithy Jerusalem versus the big, impressive Assyria. And by the end, it's a very different situation. But what do you do with a story like this? I mean, it's epic, right? It's big. What do you do with a story like this? It would be so easy to trivialize it, right? For me to say, Hezekiah was going through a tough time, there was Sennacherib, he was oppressing him. Who are the Sennacheribs in your life? You know, your boss, your mother-in-law, your neighbor, Donald Trump, you know, and sort of go from there. That would be the easy thing to do, right? Because none of us, if we're born and raised in Australia, can ever say, Hezekiah, I know what you've been through. I know what you're going through. I once went to IKEA. That was a battle for my life too, you know. We can't do it because war and oppression for us is entertainment. I mean, it's movies, it's video games. But for these guys, it was a reality with Assyria breathing down their neck, about to take it all. But it's not just a story that we can read. It's not something we can't relate to. It's actually this epic story prompts us to ask three questions. Because we might not be able to empathize with what they're going through, but we've been in situations, or we will be in situations, we're faced with dark suffering or evil or persecution or oppression. And this passage gets us to ask three questions to think about. The first is on the lips of Rabshakeh, the great propaganda artist himself. In verse 4 of chapter 36, have a look, he says this. What are you relying on? What are you relying on? Where is your confidence, in other words? And what Rabshakeh does is systematically goes through their pillars of hope, the things that they could rely on, and crushes them one by one. Starts with their allies, Egypt. In verse 6, have a look. He says, look, you are trusting in Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff that will enter and pierce the hand of anyone who leans on it. In other words, you think Egypt will save you? No. They will leave you as quick as a flash. Well, what about your military? In verse 8, he says, now make a deal with my master, the king of Syria. I'll give you 2,000 horses if you're able to supply the riders for them. But you can't. You can't even do that. Military crushed. And then he goes for the jugular. He goes for God himself. In verse 10, he says, I have attacked this land to destroy it. Oh, have I attacked this land to destroy it without the Lord's approval? The Lord said to me, attack this land and destroy it. Your God, in other words, told me to take you out. So systematically he's going through their allies, their military, even their God, and saying, you cannot hope in this. You cannot rely. You've got nothing left. The enemy is breathing down their neck. They've got nothing left. They're about to be totally destroyed. And everything they thought they could go to starts to crumble. It's like if you're in a, let's say you're in an apartment, and in the middle of the night you wake up to the smell of smoke, and you run to get the fire blanket, and it's not there. So you go get the fire extinguisher, and it's empty. So you go get turn on the water, and the water's been turned off. So you go to the fire escape, and it's blocked by fire. Everything you thought you could go to lets you down. This is the reality for Hezekiah and his people. Nothing they go to is there anymore. And for us, we may, if we're in a situation where we're faced with evil or dark suffering or oppression, the things we thought we could rely on fail us. You might think the relationships in my life will be the go-to. But what if they're not there for you? Or not there for you in the way you want them to be? Or maybe it's your possessions. You think, my job, my health, my mind, my money, that'll get me through. But what if that goes? Or maybe it might be your faith. But then people start saying, well, if you really trusted God, maybe this wouldn't happen. If you really had faith, and you start to question that. Trapped. Attacked from every angle, Hezekiah says this in verse 4 of chapter 37. Oh, chapter 3, sorry. Sorry, chapter 37, verse 3. Hear the pain of these words. They said to him, this is what Hezekiah says, today is a day of distress, rebuke, a distress, rebuke, and disgrace. For children have come to the point of birth, and there is no strength to deliver them. He's got nothing left. And suffering and evil does what only suffering and evil can do. It exposes what we rely on, and we realize we could never trust them in the first place. The second question this story gets us to ask is, who will we turn to? Who will we turn to? Because Hezekiah, when he hears this report, right? When he hears this report, he does two things. In verse 1 of chapter 37, he does this. When Hezekiah heard their report, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth. Sackcloth was a physical way of showing what you're emotionally feeling. The pain, the distress, the weeping. And then he does this. And secondly, he went to the Lord's temple. He goes and asks God for wisdom. He doesn't go to his politician and say, what's the spin on this? He doesn't give up. He goes to pray in the Lord's temple. And some of us will, when we're in turmoil, will either go generally to one or the other. See, some of us, maybe those of us who are Christian, will go to prayer. We'll run to God and we'll think the emotions are bad. Have faith, suck it up. You know, I don't cry that, I'm British. I'm British, I'm Anglican. We don't do that kind of thing, you know. And we'll just pray, but we won't weep. We won't cry. But others of us, no problem sharing our emotions. We'll cry, we'll let it out, we'll Facebook it, hashtag life sucks, you know. We'll journal it out, we'll tell everyone except God. Or at the very least, he'll be the last person to know about it. But here Hezekiah is weeping, he's mourning, and yet he's praying. And both are right responses to evil. What I love about Hezekiah's prayer, what I find interesting is what he prays and what he doesn't. Have a look with me at his prayer in verse 16. He says, Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, who is enthroned above the cherubim, you are God and you alone. Of all the kingdoms of the earth, you made the heavens and the earth. Listen closely, Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, Lord, and see. Hear all the words that Sennacherib has sent to mock the living God. And he continues. What he doesn't pray is this. God, save us because we're pretty good. I mean, I've resisted Sennacherib's temptation. you know, I've been faithful. I've been to the temple twice today. Today. You know, we're pretty deserving. Please save us. He doesn't say that. Because the problem with religion is it says, I'm good, so God, do something. I've done my bit, God, now you do your bit. Hezekiah knows that he's a place that he doesn't deserve God to rescue him, and neither are we. He's not going to manipulate or blackmail God. He's got nothing to offer. The one reason he asked God to save them is found at the end, in verse 20, the end of that prayer. He says this, now Lord our God, save us from his power so that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the Lord, you alone. See, King Sennacherib makes a fatal mistake. He says to Hezekiah, your God will be crushed just like all the others. Basically, your God is dead. You got no chance. But Hezekiah is saying, God, don't let him get away with it. Don't let him mock you. Don't let him win. Don't save us because we deserve it. Save it because of your honor. It's a very different way of praying, where it's not about you, but it's about him. It reminds me of the Lord's Prayer. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. You pray not about me, but about him. The third and final question this story prompts us to ask is, who will be there? Who will be there? And God, through the prophet Isaiah, gives two reasons how God will be there for his people. The first is as a judge. You'll notice that when Emma was reading it out in the beginning of the passage, in verse 22, it says a phrase, virgin daughter Zion. That's how it begins, virgin daughter Zion. Zion was another word really for Jerusalem. But why virgin daughter? It's this image of abuse where Assyria has violated the vulnerable. And what does God think about such things? In verse 23, he says, who is it you have mocked and blasphemed? Who you have raised your voice against and lifted your eyes in pride against the Holy One of Israel? God's not indifferent to oppression and violence. He doesn't think, meh, doesn't that matter? He takes it personally. It's against him too. And not only does God feel it, but he does something about it. I love the way in verse 26, he almost mocks Assyria. Assyria with all their dominance, with all their urban development, with all their resume of nations they've destroyed. God says in verse 26, oh, have you not heard, O Assyria? Well, I designed it long ago. I planned it in the days gone by. I've now brought it to pass. And then in verse 28, he says, but I know you're sitting down and you're going out and you're coming in and you're raging against me. And because you're raging against me and your arrogance have reached my ears, I will put my hook in your nose and my bit in your mouth and I'll make you go back the way you came. See, Assyrians think, we are so wealthy. And God says, I made that happen. Assyrians think, we are number one. And God says, Not for much longer. And so he says, we have great plans and strategies. And God says, yeah, I knew about that. And what he does, he takes them like a cow at the Easter show and says, come on, Daisy, let's go. And he moves them along. And they have no choice. And what happens in God's judgment is swift and devastating. In one night, the army is decimated. And King Sennacherib, years later, is assassinated by his two sons. You can read that in a non-biblical text of the Babylonian Chronicle. It's on the screen in the British Museum. Not that you can read that, but it can be translated for you. But some of you are probably thinking, I could never believe in a God who judges. Can I just suggest, I don't think you'd want to believe in a God who does not. Because what really is wrong with bigger nations consuming smaller nations? Because that's just the strong eating the weak. But if you believe that there is such a thing as evil, and oppression is bad and justice is important. Then who gets to make that call? And you might say it's universally true. Can I suggest what you're appealing to is that God is a judge over all, but you don't want to acknowledge it. You want the justice, but you don't want the judge. Because here God is saying what Assyria does matters. The oppression is wrong. And God alone has the right to judge the nations, to bring about ultimate justice. The second reason Isaiah gives that God will be there is found in verse 35. Have a look with me. He says this, "I will defend this city and rescue it because of me and because of my servant David." It's an odd little phrase, "my servant David," but it would have been such a comfort to Hezekiah. It was referring to a promise made many years before. A promise where God says, "I will save you, Jerusalem. I will keep you, not because you're lovely or you listen or you're loyal. I will promise to keep you, to rescue you because of a king who would be faithful." They wondered who this king was. Maybe it was Hezekiah. In the next chapter, we'll see not the case. But it was a descendant of Hezekiah, the unexpected king, King Jesus, who would save us, not because of our record, but because of his. Who would save us from sin, death, and evil, not because of our record, but because of his. I have a friend, we'll call her Sarah, for reasons that will become apparent in a moment. She grew up in Sydney. I think, funnily enough, she's actually Assyrian by descendants. But she became a Christian in her mid-20s. Life was going well until she went home and she told her dad that she became a Christian. And her dad was furious and said to her, "I wish you were never born." That pillar of hope, her family, crumbled. And she was kicked down instantly. All the things that she had, gone, taken from her. That pillar of hope crumbled. And then the money that she had access to and the inheritance that was coming was gone, taken out of the will. Money was gone. In a matter of moments, all the hopes, the things that she thought she could rely on came crumbling down. But the only thing that stood for Sarah was this "my servant David," was this unexpected king. And you know why it was a comfort to her? Because Jesus Christ had all his pillars of hope crumble before his eyes. As he was heading to that cross, the ultimate rescue plan, all his friends and family abandoned him. The government system was no good. It was corrupt. He couldn't rely on that. All the things that he had were taken from him, so he was naked on a cross. And even God the Father abandoned and forsook him. Everything that he thought you would normally rely on was taken. And you know what's amazing? Jesus actually intentionally entered that situation, knowing it would happen. And he did that because you and I don't have a choice, right? When it happens, it just happens and we've got to deal with it. But he went into that situation. He did it so that when you and I experience dark suffering or evil or oppression or persecution, and everything goes, he will not. Everything may fail, but he will not. See, he experienced hopelessness so that you could have hope. He lost it all so that you could have something precious. And that is the confidence that Jesus is with you. A confidence not that you'll be free from suffering and pain to come. No, Hezekiah and his people, next chapter, life was not rosy. But it was a confidence that Jesus is with you, not because of your record, but because of his. Not because you are faithful, but because he was faithful. I don't know when your day of distress, rebuke will come. I don't know which pillars of hope will crumble in your life. And when that day comes, you will naturally ask the questions, what am I relying on? It will show who you turn to. But the question is, who will be there? If you're a Christian here tonight, you know that answer. Jesus will be there. But if you're not, can I suggest you make tonight the night that you ask him to be there for the first time? That pillar of hope, Jesus, cannot crumble, cannot fade, cannot go. I'm going to close by reading Romans 8. These precious, precious words which capture this. Listen to this. Who can separate us from the love of Christ? Can affliction or anguish or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? As it is written, because of you we are being put to death all day long. We are counted as sheep to be slaughtered. No. In all these things, we are more than victorious through him who loved us. For I am persuaded that not even death or life, angels or rulers, things present or things to come, hostile powers, height or depth, or any other created thing will have the power to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus, our Lord.